Let's see what we have this evening. The first question we have here. Dear Ajahn, Nibbida as regards meditation seems at odds with loving kindness to ourselves. Can we suffer Nibbida, or is it complete rejection required? Nibbida is this wonderful little word. It's like, yes, we're actually on the wheel of samsara, going round and round and round. And just letting it be, you know, is just like being in an aircraft which is plummeting to the ground. We have this thing called Nibbida, which is like the ejection button. You press it, and it means you get out of samsara. I always call it samsara's ejection seat. I don't know, it's a long time since I've really watched movies, but I always remember the James Bond movie where there was, he was driving his car and there was some person trying to kill him next to him, and so he pressed the button and he went through the roof. That was really cool. I often thought that sometimes during interview time that... No, I won't do that. No, I won't do that. But it's Nibbida. What it really means is you see there's a problem. Sometimes we never feel it's a problem. We think, oh yeah, just we keep going on. We actually see the problem. It's just not coming from you. It's just natural. You just turn away from these things. You know, this is not for everybody, but you know, when I was a lay person, it just didn't make any sense. Now, why did I have to go off and just work for things like money or fame and stuff like that? Because I saw many people who were very wealthy, much wealthier than I was, and saw people who were they were Nobel Prize winners, some really famous people. Now, one of the people I saw over here in Perth was Sir Roger Penrose. He was the person who invented, or actually discovered, black holes. I know he's one of the most famous physicists in the world, and he was, you know, coming through Perth, and I got connections, so we had dinner, but didn't have any dinner with him, obviously, just sat down and had a cup of tea. And this fellow is brilliant, you know, Sir Roger Penrose. It was his ideas which Stephen Hawking piggybacked on to get the Big Bang Theory. But Roger Penrose, that was really interested in trying to talk to him. A brilliant mind, see if he could understand about, you know, a bit about meditation or the mind and stuff like that. It was impossible to talk to him about anything. And so there's maybe about 30 or 40 people at this dinner. It was in the Gravity Center in Gingin. And then, you know, after a while, you know, I was sitting next to somebody from NASA and just talking amazing sort of conversation about stuff. And people were just chatting away. And then I looked up and there was this, you know, the star of the evening. So Roger Penrose was sitting there, or rather standing there, like a wallflower. He couldn't hold a conversation with anybody. Brilliant in his field. Excuse me, stupid in life. And I never wanted to be like that. So you get Nibbida, you get rejection to that. What do you want to do that for? So after a while, you know, people may be like in the army. And after a while, when they see all the destruction, they get Nibbida from that. It just moves you away from it. It's not so much negativity, it's just more like, you know, well, I can do better than that. This is not really leading anywhere. So that's what Nibbida means. And it is loving kindness. It's just a natural thing which comes up. Kindness to yourself, kindness towards others. Dear Ajahn Brahm, because Nibbida actually comes up, I should have mentioned this when I mentioned the early on, from happiness, from Sukhi no Chittang Samadhiati, from happiness, joy, you get this beautiful stillness, and from stillness you get seeing things as they truly are, and from seeing things as they truly are you get Nibbida. So, wow, I'm in a mess here. I mean, it's about time that sort of you just move away from these stuff you've been carrying around all the time. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have been meditating, sitting both indoors and outdoors today. I realize it is easier to keep present breath outside with all the bugs, flies and bird sounds. especially when the flies are going up your nose, you're very present. Indoors, when it's completely quiet, my mind wanders a lot. It should be easy if it's quiet, right? Am I weird? Of course you are weird. No, you're not. That's all it really is. Yeah, it's true. If you, say, ride a very fast car or on a motorbike going at 200 kilometers an hour, of course you're really present. You have to be. So many times people use those really scary extreme sports or extreme situations to almost force themselves to be in this moment. But then that's a bit, you know, false. So why can't you just be in there without the fear, without the bugs, without the concern about what's happening to you right now, without the fear of self-preservation? Why can't you have the present moment awareness where it's nice and comfortable? And after a while, it's because, you know, you find you don't have to be present. You like to be present. So it's not because of the compulsion, because the bugs are not allowing you to start thinking about stuff. It is because of the joy of just being here. You don't need the... It's very easy to be in the present moment, have a straight back, when the Zen master is walking behind you with a big stick. Yeah, of course, I'm really awake. But yeah, that's from the wrong reasons. So why can't we just be awake, not out of fear, but out of joy? So that's actually one of the wonderful things. Yes, you know, it is easier, but it's from the wrong reasons. Number one, why don't enlightened monks say they're enlightened? Won't it serve as an inspiration to all? Okay. Sometimes somebody asked me this question years... Actually, it was... You know, one thing is they're not supposed to tell lay people, first of all. And the reason is this. Because, you should all know that if you give a donation of food or just a cup of tea to an enlightened monk, you get far more returns on your investment than if you just give it to some scallywag monk. You get more bang for your bucks. And that's said in the suttas, so you can't really deny that. So, what happens in practice in places, especially places like Thailand, they're always looking, which monk is enlightened? Because you've only got a certain amount of resources. You have to make sure it goes as far as possible. You can't waste them to just ordinary little monks. So because of that, one of my earliest memories of staying with Ajahn Chah, there was maybe in that time maybe 40 or 50 monks there, and the food was, I've mentioned the food before, disgusting food, usually sticky rice and rotten fish curry, and that's about it. And then one day, we were just waiting there for the food after alms round to pass the food out. And then a big pickup truck, you know, what we call like a ute in Australia, drew up and had, the back was full of pots of curries and sweets and really delicious food from town. And the driver came out, and as soon as I saw that, I thought, you know, it's a young monk. You know, you had your desire and craving. I thought, wow, going to eat well today. And the driver came out, and he came into the dining hall and said, where's Ajahn Chah today? I said, oh, Ajahn Chah, he's been invited to do a blessing in town. Oh, really? So the driver got in his car and drove off. And that really hurt. Because his idea was, why waste all that food on ordinary monks? He wouldn't get the bang for his bucks. So because of that, you know, if we say who's enlightened, who's not, who's a stream winner, who's not a stream winner, it creates the two-tier sangha. We have those who are just ordinary, we call them putuchanas, ordinary. And those who are, you know, stream winners and more advanced, we call them Aryas. What I call creating the Aryastocracy. Not the aristocracy, the Ariostocracy. But it has a class system in the Sangha. And that has terrible, terrible sort of effects. It means that some people or some monks, you know, think, well, I'm enlightened as anybody else. And sometimes they fake it because, you know, you get more gains, honors, and fame, you know, more respect. You know, and sometimes you see some poor monks, you know, they've been a monk for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, and they say, well, you know, what have you got? They say, well, they're saying, well, nothing very much. And that's very dispiriting. So instead, we don't even mention that. You know, who's enlightened and who isn't. Because then you just see the Sangha as a whole, monks and nuns. So not just distinguishing. So this is in order not to actually make distinctions, you know, between who is and who isn't. And also that, I think when I was in Sri Lanka in a monastery once, and they were videoing this. And so again, one of the monks, they came up and asked on camera, he said, Ajahn Brahm, are you enlightened? And, you know, I thought, I've had enough of being asked this and trying to get out of, you know, giving a proper answer or whatever. So I just told him. I said, exactly. You're interested now, aren't you? You're paying attention. Crazy. So I told them that, because, you know, in the Dharma, those who know some Buddhism, you know that, you know, there's no self in here. It's just what we call the five components of existence, the five khandhas. You know, there's a body, you know, stuff. You know, there is the experience, or what I call the Vedana. Or Vedana, that's the experience. People call it feeling, but it's mere like experience. And then you have the perceptions, you have the mental formations, which is mostly your will, or the will rather, and the six different types of consciousness, the consciousnesses. Those are the called the five khandhas, the five components of existence. And so I told these monks, if you can please tell me which of these khandhas is enlightened, then I'll answer your question. You know, is it the body which is enlightened? Is it the experience? Is it the perceptions? Is it the will? Is it the consciousness? None of it belongs to me, nothing to do with me. It's none of my business. So if you can actually point to what's enlightened, then I can answer your question. The monk was actually understood enough to say, oh, sadhu, 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 great. So who is enlightened? You can't say Ajahn Chah is enlightened. You know this, you read the book, No Ajahn Chah. What's enlightened? So what instead we say is, what's been eliminated, what's disappeared. And that's why, you know, we published that book, The Art of Disappearing. Not The Art of Becoming Enlightened. Same thing really, but The Art of Disappearing. It gives a much better description of what we're doing here. Not trying to attain more status. I'm more enlightened than you are, na 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 na. My teacher's more enlightened, he's got more psychic powers than your teacher has, na 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 na. Theravada's more advanced than Mahayana, no it isn't, Mahayana's more advanced than Theravada, na 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 na. That's just so unspiritual. You know, there's something terribly wrong with that. And indeed, is one of the suttas where, and I often quote this one, I forget actually where it is now, actually I've been in Lito, where the two monks, Venwa Ananda was the Buddha's attendant, and a monk came up to the Buddha and said, one who is an arahat, fully enlightened, never thinks, never even perceives or conceives that they're better than anybody else, nor worse than anybody else, nor the same as anybody else. The Buddha said, sadhu, 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 yeah, that's true. And another monk came up and he said almost exactly the same. One who is an enlightened being never thinks they're better than anybody else, never thinks they're worse than anybody else, never thinks they're the same as anybody else. Correct. And then the Buddha turned around and said, that was how arahats let me know that they've attained that goal. Not better, not worse, not the same. Just nothing to compare, nothing to measure. So you disappear, you vanish. So that is what being enlightened is. That's why you don't say you're enlightened, that misses the point. It says, how much disappeared are you? Like I mentioned the other day, Ananda Mangala, how illuminated are you? The closer you are to enlightenment, to nirvana, the more illuminated you are. So see if you can become highly illuminated, or extremely illuminated, or totally illuminated. Now that's actually more close. So if a monk says, oh, I'm totally illuminated, that's pretty good. How did meditators around Ajahn Chah know he was enlightened? There was, as I say, it's easy to know the person's not enlightened. So, one of those stories was from the Chinese tradition about the monk, the young monk, who went up to see his abbot one day and told him, said, look, I've done my basic training, I've done a lot of service, my meditation's very good, I really want to go full steam for nirvana, for enlightenment. And the young monk said, just maybe, you know, about 10-15 minutes walk away from this monastery, there is a lake. And in the middle of the lake there is an island, uninhabited, secluded. May I have permission to build a tiny small hut there? And so I can just practice in solitude. And all I will ask is one of the temple attendants will just row over in a boat once a week to send me supplies. And so and I could get supplies and I'll give him a little note what I will need for next week. So I can just live on some rice and beans, grow a few vegetables, whatever. So I can have perfect solitude. And the abbot said, okay. And so he went, he built a nice little hut in the middle of the island in the lake. And he lived there for 3 years, perfect solitude, getting deeper and deeper into his meditation. Until one day he thought that was it. He was enlightened. Now what do you do next once you're enlightened? So the next time the attendant came in the boat, he asked the attendant, can I please have next week a quill pen, actually no, a brush, some parchment and some ink. I want to write some calligraphy. Just like you got me to write calligraphy in Melbourne last June or July, or August or something, whenever, September, to raise funds for the NBM project. So, I write some calligraphy. And so, 1 week later, he came over with the parchment, the brush, and some ink. And that monk, he meditated so deeply, because if you're going to write calligraphy, you have to be so powerful. Your mindfulness is, you can't force it, you have to just totally get out of the way and just let the brush move by itself. So when he was ready, he unfurled the parchment and he wrote this poem in 4 lines. It translated as, the diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. And that was like code, it's an expression which monks use to say they were enlightened. So he wrote that and the calligraphy was just immaculate. And he let the parchment dry and he waited for the time to pass until the attendant came and he gave the parchment to the attendant with the instructions to hand it to the abbot. And then for 7 days he waited and he started just thinking about, you know, what the abbot would do, another enlightened being in this world, just how he'd be so proud as his student, and how that calligraphy would probably be framed and hung in one of the big temples, you know, maybe even in the main temple, maybe in a museum for posterity, you know, the expression of a newly enlightened monk. And so he was actually quite pleased, you know, when 1 week later the attendant came back and said, "This is from the abbot." And it was another parchment. It looked surprisingly similar to his own, and when he unfurled it, he realized it was his own, the one he sent to the abbot last week. And his eyes went wide when he saw over the first line in this incredible, artistic, immaculate calligraphy, the abbot had written, scrawled would be the better word, in red biro pen, fart. F-A-R-T. What's he going on? The second line, alone for 3 years. There was another F-A-R-T, this time in capital letters. And the third line is no longer moved. F-A-R-T underlined by the four worldly winds. F-A-R-T underlined three times with three exclamation marks after it. Now this piece of calligraphy took 3 years of solitude and hard meditation to actually create, and this stupid abbot had destroyed it. You know, he's just not a monk, a punk. Just doesn't know just, you know, any artistic taste at all, and can't recognize enlightenment when it's in front of his fat nose. This was too much. So that monk, he just ran out of his little hut, managed to catch the attendant, you know, before he actually was too far across the lake, called him back, got in the boat and said, "Take me to that abbot." And he went back over the lake, into the abbot's office, stormed in there, "What you did this for?" And the abbot very calmly sort of stood up, and he opened out the scroll, and he read it out to the hermit monk. "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds." That's what you wrote, monk. "And four little farts have blown you clean across the lake for the first time in 3 years." That's what the four winds really mean. And no, the diligent monk understood, "Oh, I'm not enlightened after all," and just went back for another few years on the island. Well, that's typical. That's how we find out someone's enlightened or not. Just find out some weak point, abuse them. So how do you know Ajahn Chah was enlightened? Yeah, you can't know. Maybe I can, because I was living with him for 9 years, checking him out, just what he was doing. And, you know, it was always kept an even. People did some weird stuff to him and just shouted at him, accused him, and all sorts of stuff. He was always very, he never got angry back. And also never had any sort of craving to speak of. Because I remember just the one time which really convinced me, which just pushed me over the edge, yeah, that was an enlightened being. It was not so much his teachings. Teachings were fantastic. Things like the sitting under the mango tree simile. That was brilliant. And, you know, just don't shake the tree. Sit down still. Put your hand out, and then the mango will fall. Shake the tree, climb the tree, no way, you're just wasting your time. That type of effort will never get you a mango. You're going to be perfectly still, let go. And then when you really are still, then mangoes will fall. So, he asked me once to go up to his room to get something. And he wouldn't allow anyone to go up into his room. It was just a novice who would clean that up for him. Not like me. Any riffraff can go into my room and see my cave. But, so they went into his room. I went into his room and there was nothing there. And that was just amazing. There was a grass mat, I think a wooden pillow. And there was a robe rack with just one spare robe on it. I think that's all I can remember. And that was just so wonderful. This was such a famous monk. And you had Queen of Thailand went up there, and generals, incredibly wealthy people, give him anything. But, you know, where he lived was nothing. And that really sort of inspired me to see actually how he really lived. So anyway, that was really good. Anyway, dear Ajahn, on my walk today, on my walk today, I decided to wave to a kangaroo. To my surprise, a kangaroo waved back at me. Do jhana growers kangaroos know how to wave? I know the old story over, it's this indigenous culture, it's incredibly fantastic. So there was an indigenous man who was with an Australian friend of mine, and they were driving along, and unfortunately they hit a rabbit. You've seen some rabbits over here. So they hit a rabbit, so they stopped. And to all intents and purposes, that rabbit was dead. So the indigenous elder, hang on a moment, went into his little bag he was carrying with him and got out some oil and started rubbing it into the rabbit's tummy. And then the rabbit, very slowly, after about 2 or 3 minutes of very gently rubbing this ointment, whatever it was, into the rabbit's tummy, the rabbit started to twitch. No sign it was like alive. So he kept on rubbing it in, and the rabbit twitched again, and then more rubbing it in, and then the rabbit opened its eyes, and then wore in, and the rabbit sort of got onto its 4 feet, very unstable at first, and started to walk away. And every now and again, every 2 or 3 steps, the rabbit, maybe out of gratitude, and we'll find out in a few minutes, he actually would turn around and wave back at the indigenous elder. And every more 3 steps, the rabbit was getting stronger. More 3 steps, and it was more steady on its feet, but always turn around and wave back. And then after a few more meters, it started to trot. But it would always run a little bit and then turn around and wave back. And by the time it got almost out of sight, it was running as good as any rabbit could run. But it would always stop and wave back at the indigenous elder. And of course the Australian friend said, what the heck is that? What did you rub into that rabbit? Oh, he said, that was, I got it in the chemist. It's hair restorer with a permanent wave. It's a joke. Hair restorer with a permanent wave. Exactly. So someone has put some hair restorer on that kangaroo, so it's now got a permanent wave. You know what I reckon? I reckon the kangaroo was just waving away the flies. Okay, dear Ajahn, can you explain the meaning of the 10 names of Buddha? For example, what does Vijja, Charana, Sampanno means? Do their names apply to an arahat as well? Some of them do, some of them don't. Because Vijja, Charana, Sampanno, Vijja means wisdom. Understanding that avijja, delusion. Vijja is like the opposite of delusion. And it's where we get the word vijja, witches from. Witchcraft. That means the opposite of avijja. That's what we're doing here. So those words, they go into English language, but that's where vijja is. Charano is conduct. So it is, sampanno means, endowed with proper wisdom and conduct. Not just wisdom, but the conduct. In other words, just because somebody says something and it's very profound and wise, that doesn't mean they're enlightened. It's just how they behave as well. That's really important. And it got the arahat, it says the arahat as well. So it does apply to some of those ones, apply to the Buddha only, some to the arahat as well. Dear Ajahn, to add something more to your last night's story, which one? Something I have experienced is that my usually unsettled stomach keeps to its highest standard during China Grove retreats. My mind is happy it could be Bianca's secret magic she adds to the food she serves. Well, I said this wee jar is witchcraft, so maybe the secret ingredient is magic. Magic pudding. Magic, I don't know, magic. No, it's the magic over here. It's just the kindness. And it's not just her, it's all the people who actually come and feed us. And sometimes, have you ever noticed if people actually, if they sell food for money, that's one thing. But if they do it out of love, care, that's the secret ingredient, like dana, giving. So, you know, the people who came here today, you know, it was actually your sister. It was going to be sister Shirley and her friends. And they come here, they don't have to come. They don't get any money for this, we don't pay them. They come all this way, you know, to feed you with their friends. It's wonderful that they come here to feed you, and they just get so much joy out of it. Not for money, for some other thing, for joy, for giving. And that joy, that giving, is why the food tastes delicious. It's pure food, because it comes from a pure heart. That's the magic ingredient. So what Bianca does. How long have Bianca's been cooking for retreats? Such a long, no, must be about 30 years now. Over 30 years. So, all this time, that's, you know, her little dana, which she does all the time. It's amazing. And what do you do that for? Don't get paid for it. Just, it's dana, kindness. That's a beautiful thing which we have. Ajahn, it is said that a person can be a stream winner by listening to Dharma talks and practicing giving generosity. Is there any truth in this? Can a person be a stream winner without meditation? Now, one of the things with, if you read those suttas, is it seems to be that even, I mean, the most extreme case is these assassins who were hired to kill the Buddha. And the way it worked was they hired one assassin to do the deed, and two assassins would wait for the first assassin and kill the first assassin. And then four will kill the two, eight will kill the four, 60 will kill the eight, 32 will kill the 60, and that way it would just, you know, no one knows who murdered whom. And so that was the scheme. And so the first assassin crept up to the Buddha with a big knife to kill the Buddha. And the Buddha, he's so kind and so nice. How can I do this? It reminds me of my father, just after the Second World War, with his brother, I think before I was born. And you know, they were staying in a very cheap place over in Fulham, not much to and that's West London, not much money around. So they managed to get a couple of chickens, to raise the chickens, you know, not just for eggs, but for, you know, to eat them. And then when they've had the chicken for a while, it was time to kill them, to put it in the pot. And but by that time, it was like a pet. So, oh, I can't do that anymore. When you get someone, even like a chicken, how could you kill a chicken if it becomes a nice pet? So because of that, they lost a lot of money at that scheme. Had a chicken, but they could not put it in the pot. So if you can do that with a chicken, imagine a Buddha. How can you kill a Buddha? You're just too soft and just too nice. Too much compassion, because it's possible to kill them. I remember just a story years and years ago of it was a Hindu yogi. He was wandering late at night through some really bad part of New York, and a couple of New York thugs, you know, they sort of cornered him and said, "Give us your wallet, Mac." That's what he used to say in those days. Honestly, this is, I'm never reading this. That's what he said. "Give us your wallet, Mac." He said, "I don't have a wallet. I don't have any money. Don't give us that. We'll knife you." But he was so calm and peaceful. And he said, "Well, you know, I'm a holy man. You know, I just spend the time just living simply and serving." And he was so sincere that after a while, they said, "Oh, really, I'm sorry. We made a mistake. have a wonderful night, sir. And they called him sir. And because they called him sir, that was in the front page of the, I think, New York Times the next day. It was unheard of that these thugs would actually call anyone sir. And it's just his kindness, his gentleness. He was just unable to be harmed. And so that's the same with the Buddhas, even more than that. So they couldn't harm him. So the first of those assassins said, oh, I'm terribly sorry, I ask forgiveness, I shouldn't have really done this, you know, to be an assassin. And the Buddha forgave him and gave him some dharma, and he became a stream winner. And then the other two came along and said, have you seen this assassin, not assassin, this guy with a knife coming around? And the Buddha said, oh yeah, he came to kill me. But, you know, I taught him the dharma, and he taught the other two, and gave them forgiveness, and they became stream winners. The whole lot became stream winners in the end. And I think, that is just really just extreme. Someone comes to kill you, and they end up becoming stream winners. You know, no meditation, no mindfulness, no compassion at all. But just in the Buddhist, but what actually happens, the answer to that is, if you really know your Pali language, that if you say you're a stream winner, sometimes it means you're on the path to being a stream winner. Because if you enter the path of being a stream winner, the goal of being a stream winner is certain. You can't U-turn. What that means is, just like, you know, you may have upset like a mafia person, and the mafia, maybe you haven't paid the debt, or you've told the police about where their headquarters are, what they're up to, and the mafia says, you're dead. Well, not dead, I'm still alive, but you're as good as dead. You're the walking, that's not walking dead, that's something else, isn't it? It's a movie or something. But your death is so certain, though you might as well call you dead. And we see that in Pali. If something is so certain, then it's as if it's already happened. That's an idiom of Pali. And so if you're bound to be a stream winner, there's no possibility of anything else, then they call you a stream winner. It's certain. It has to happen. So that makes sense to me. It's just a Pali that people, yeah, they've become inspired by the Buddha, and because of that they will practice, they will meditate, they will keep precepts, they will be kind and mindful. They can't not do that. Just like the other day when someone says, you know, can I stop meditating now? No way. It's not up to you anymore. Being brainwashed, you can't do anything else. Somebody said that years ago. Once you've heard this dharma, you just can't forget it. You may go away, leave it for a while, but just it's got you. And that's like with a stream winner. So that's what I understand. Yeah, they may listen to dharma, practice giving generosity, but that makes them enter the path to being a stream winner. And being a stream winner is certain. So they sometimes say in the Pali, yeah, you're a stream winner. You're not really yet, but it's going to happen. Dear Ajahn, I am always, and I mean always, being asked to love myself more and stop doing more for others and not giving back, not bad to me. Does loving myself, giving and wanting good things, getting and achieving goals for myself lead to craving? A question I sometimes ponder, where to draw the line between wanting more versus just loving myself? Okay, the story of when I bless weddings. When I bless a wedding, I usually start with the bride. And I look at her and say, now you're a married woman, you must not think of yourself. And she always smiles sweetly and nods her head. Then I look at the guy, and if he's an Australian Caucasian, I say the same. Now you're a married man, you must not think of yourself. And look, this is not termed discrimination. This is based on personal experience. He always pauses. He does. But eventually he gives in. He said, okay, I won't think of myself. It's not as automatic as the bride. But then, looking at the groom, and I say, you're a married man now, so from this moment on, you must not think of her, your wife. And then I look at the bride and say the same thing. Now you are a married woman. From today on, you must not think of him, your husband. And this is always such a wonderful moment. Because they're thinking, who the hell have we invited to bless our marriage? This crazy guy? But then you give them the answer to the riddle. When you're married, you must not think of yourself. When you're married, you must not think of your partner. When you're married, the third option, you think of us. And they get it straight away. Oh, yeah! Because, you know, in a relationship, if it's all about me, of course there's no relationship there. If it's always about giving to the others, then you get burnt out. Nothing in it for you. So, relationship is about us. We're in it together. That's the answer. So the idea of Mahayana, sacrificing yourself for others, Hinayana, just in it for yourself, both are wrong. It's about us. So you love yourself, so you can give to others. It's all about us. You love us. Please tell us an Ajahn Gunha story. Ah, Ajahn Gunha story, okay. You all know the snake story, don't you? No? Okay, Ajahn Gunha and the snake. So, I think I told her, didn't I? No, I haven't told her, okay. He was, I think I told this recently, so anyway, not here, must be. So, he was meditating in the jungle with about 5 or 6 other monks. Real jungle. And they opened their eyes because they could hear a big animal coming towards them. It was a snake. A big snake. A king cobra. And in that part of Thailand, they had a nickname for king cobra. The one-step snake. Because if it bit you, that's all you'd have left, one step, and then you're dead. It was very venomous and very aggressive and dangerous. So, this snake came up. Of course, to the boss monk, Ajahn Gunha, came right up to him, lifted up its head, opened its hood right in front of him. Right in front of his nose. Now, what did Ajahn Gunha do? Did he run away? You cannot run, those snakes are faster than you. Did he close his eyes and meditate? No. He lifted up his hand and patted the cobra on the head, saying in Thai, "Thank you for coming to visit." And what do you think that cobra did? It's so rare to get patted on the head by a holy monk. That cobra enjoyed every minute of that. Just, you know, pat your head, oh, it's so nice. It's so rare. So, the cobra just sucked it all in, just drank it all, the kind of compassion, just such a happy cobra. And of course, you know, once he had enough, the cobra put his hood in, went down, went to see another monk. Lifted up his head. And that monk said, no way, go back to him. And that was the Ajahn Gunha story. So, maybe 3 or 4 years later, we invited Ajahn Gunha to spend the rains retreat at Bodhinyana Monastery over the road. He's a good friend. And, or maybe a couple of years, no, maybe 3 or 4 years after that time. So, we were just building our main hall. In fact, we hadn't got even the building permission for that main hall yet. And I was a main builder at the time. We'd done all the plans, submitted them in for approval for our local council. And so the mayor came over to inspect the place. And the mayor of Serpentine Zeradale Council, Clem Kentish his name was, he came up, and because it was an official visit, he was wearing a nice suit. However, like many Australians, and I'm just following tradition with my shape, he was actually very, very replete. He had a rounded personality and a rounded body as well. So I noticed, you know, the poor buttons of his jacket were just, you know, almost popping off. He was really tubby. So what did Ajahn Gunhard do? He looked at this mare, went right up to him before I could stop him, and started rubbing his tummy. He rubbed the mare's tummy before I could stop him. And I thought, oh, crikey, that's it. We'll never get any... You don't do that to Australian mares, rubbing their tummy because they're fat. So I thought, that's it. No more building, no more approval. We're going to be shut down. But to my great delight, surprise and delight, that mare, his face creased up with delight. And he started, the only thing I can describe, like gurgling like a baby. He loved every minute of that. And from that time on, he became, you know, a really close friend of this monastery. Even though I went to his funeral when he finally passed away. So we got our planning permission, no problem at all, building permission, really easy. Even though we shouldn't have got, because you know that hall over there, you know who the builder is on the building license? Me. It's a public building, you're not supposed to do that. So the old building, so I said, don't tell anybody, you know, I'll get in big trouble by giving you the building license, and you know, you're supposed to get a real builder to do a public building, but it all worked out okay. So thank you, Ajahn Gunhard, for getting our building license. So he's still alive. Over in MBM, if you just need, you know, in Melbourne, if you need to get the license for stuff, just get Ajahn Gunhard over there, invite the mayor, a few pats on the belly, and you get anything you want. So that's an Ajahn Gunhard story. Ajahn, is it true that someone can receive our metta when we do metta meditation? Is there any particular condition that make it possible to happen? Yes, they can. So, sometimes I do this. I just, you know, get a bit fed up with doing it the same old way every time. But at the end of the retreat, we do a metta meditation. And if you really want to prove that, once you get the metta really going, really zapping, then I ask you to, okay, now take someone, not here, but, you know, really, you know, you're close to, maybe a good friend or someone who's ill in hospital or something, and just really think of them, really visualize them and really blast them with really strong metta. And then when you're doing that, I just have a look at the clock, and I write it down. And then after the metta meditation is finished, I'll tell you that was the time you did that. And when you go back home, give them a call, but no leading questions. Say, oh, just how are you? I was just thinking about you today. And what were you, now they'll probably say, and it always happens, they say, oh, you know, I was thinking about you too. About what time? And they would say, no, 8:50, that's the time on here now. I said, that was exactly the time I said you were doing loving kindness meditation to them. Just, you know, prove it. So you think of somebody, I take the time down. You don't worry about the time. I just disturb my meditation to take down the time. And then check it out, see if it's true. And the reason I don't like doing that, because people start calling me in the night time or whatever, and says, a call for you, Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, it works, Ajahn Brahm. Yeah, I know it works. Okay. And then another call, goes, oh, yeah, it works. Yeah, of course. So that's why sometimes I don't do it anymore. But it does work. You prove it for yourself. It's weird, but it happens. Thank you, Ajahn, for these wonderful talks. I was worried about coming for this retreat, but I'm enjoying every minute of this retreat. Thank you once again for making meditation easy. Yeah, easy peasy meditation. It should be easy. What's so difficult about letting go and being kind and being gentle and being peaceful? It should be the easiest thing in the world. Relaxing. Meditate, you know, at your stages, at your level, some a lot, some not so much. getting a little bit of happiness and joy, no fear, no pressure, letting go of the tension, and then meditation happens. Ajahn. Ajahn is essential for realization of the truths and the achievement of the four states certified in Arahat. Thank you. Yes, of course they are. But it doesn't mean, oh, I've got to get the jhana. It's just what happens. The stages of letting go. So the more you let go, the more these things happen. It's nothing about you. The stages of you disappearing. The great vanishing act. And that's what happens. Jhanas. The nice thing about it is it's so blissful. So it's wonderful. It's a taste of freedom. That's the third noble truth of letting go of the path to Nibbana. And they say Nibbana paramang sukhang. Nibbana is the highest bliss. So the more bliss you get, the more exit, the closer you are to enlightenment. Isn't that wonderful? Not a path of pain. More pain. The more pain you have, the more close you are to being a saint. That's the path of asceticism. And people really got into that, whipping themselves. Even today in the Philippines, you know, the people on Easter time, they volunteer to be nailed onto a cross. There's something really weird about that. But in Buddhism, we just volunteer to bliss out. That's much more fun. And also, if you get one jhana, even the first jhana, the Buddha described it as sambodhisukha, the experience. Enlightenment, happiness. It's not enlightenment, but it's so close. He described it as sambodhisukha, enlightenment, happiness. You can do that. I understand that there are other traditions that advise to count the best 1 to 10 repeats lead to calm the mind. What is your view of this method? Yeah, I did that for quite a few years when I first started. Yeah, it works okay, but after a while, you know, when I was really sleepy in the mornings, you know, I was counting the breath, and I was about up to about 26 until I realized I'd gone past the 10. You know, breathing in, one out, one in, two out, two in, three out, three in, four out, 26. I lost my mindfulness. And it was just such hard work. Especially if you're an accountant, you can do it that way. But, you know, these days, if you're in a bit of a rush, breathing in, 1, 2, 6, 4, 2, 4, 6, 8. Do it quickly. So it's okay to do it at the beginning, but don't stay with the counting. It just gives a bit more sort of work to do. People say that Buddhists may become extinct one day. Yeah, exactly, because we're endangered species. The Buddhist nuns, bhikkhunis, they're on the World Wildlife Fund. They're pretty wild bhikkhunis. Endangered species, so you shouldn't really be exporting them, you know, overseas. Unless you've got a license. So, Buddhists may become extinct one day since we are so gentle and not go around converting people. We do convert people by stealth. Although mindfulness is getting more popular, few people know it stems from Buddhism. What is your opinion on that? We get in there. Buddhism is growing in the world. It's expanding. So am I. So anyway, it's just, you know, because you know, when you get science involved, you find it's amazing just how much Buddhism is able to be unchallenged by science. And one of the interesting things, now mindfulness is becoming popular, but what I'm really interested in is this part of the modern science and the nature of the mind. For many scientists, mind does not exist. Just a byproduct of the brain. So I gave a talk just, you know, stirring people up. There's no such thing as secular mindfulness. If it's secular, you shouldn't call it mind. You should call it brain. So I said you should call that secular brainfulness, not mindfulness. Mind is something different. So anyway, The mindfulness is getting popular, it works, but it needs more. And so many people are now starting to introduce their things like compassion, my kindfulness, not mindfulness, but kindfulness, with ethics as well, and all this other stuff. Just doing mindfulness without the other factors of the Eightfold Path, I mentioned that's like a monoculture. If you have a forest, you need so many different species of trees, otherwise it gets a very sick forest. And it's the same if you just have just one part of the Eightfold Path and forget about the others. Yeah, it's okay, but you know, it's not really the full thing. And it won't get extinct, because as the Buddha said, and sometimes as people, like you can see that the monks even, who don't really understand Buddhism, and I'm saying this carefully, but it's true, and they just abandon the principles of Buddhism because they're afraid that Buddhism is going to become extinct, taken over by Muslims, Rohingyas, or goodness knows what else. They're the ones who destroyed Buddhism. And the Buddha said, as long as people practice the Eightfold Path, there will be stream winners, vajra-turners, non-returners, arahats in this world. As long as there's arahats in this world, Buddhism will never become extinct. During meditation, the deeper it gets, the more my neck slants towards the right, every time when it hurts. I am trying to trust in my body's wisdom in healing itself, but the pain makes me end the meditation. Please advise how I should handle it. And it's very easy. You can get a little stick in the back and just tie your head so it can't go to the right. Like a little brace. Like those neck braces people have. You know, that when you sort of injure your neck, you get a neck brace that just can't go to the right. There's all this, like sometimes people used to tell me they have this terrible problem about saliva, too much saliva. If they swallow it, then it disturbs them. If they don't swallow it, it starts dribbling, and they're really embarrassed about dribbling during the meditation. That's only what babies do. So the solution was, because I know many dentists, to get one of those little machines. So while you're meditating, and then the problem's solved. Okay, anyway, so the more your neck starts towards the right every time and it hurts, I think somebody mentioned that during their interviews, the deeper you go in meditation, the body looks after itself. So just go a little bit deeper in meditation and the problem will solve itself. Ajahn, you mentioned clearly the key to being in the moment is not to have an end target or measurements in mind, but even for a monk, isn't as contradictory as the end goal or target is to stop the rebirth of oneself. That's called vibhavadanha, the craving to annihilate yourself. And that's one of the reasons we keep on getting reborn. So, if you have an end goal, a target to stop the rebirth of oneself, who's trying to stop the rebirth? The simile from Oliver Twist is like trying to eat your own head. You trying to stop rebirth, you're doing something. It's a craving, it's a wanting, it keeps rebirth going. So you don't aim to stop rebirth of oneself. You aim just to stop your whole stupid idea of being somebody who can do anything at all. To let go. To disappear. To vanish. So at the end of this existence, when the buzz comes to pick you up, to take you to your next existence, it looks around and can't find you. Disappeared, you're invisible. There's no way to take you to your next destination. Just like at the end of this retreat, when the car comes to take you to the airport, they look for you here, they look for you there, and they can't find you anywhere. You vanish, disappear, so they go without you. That is like the arahat doesn't get reborn. Actually, when I'm watching my breath during meditation, sometimes saliva keeps building up. You see, I saw this before it came. My powers are great. I have to swallow it from time to time. What would you suggest to stop this? You know the answer. Just swallow. And just swallow, and just after a while, you just forget about it. Ajahn Brahm, have you felt tired? How do you overcome tiredness? I do feel tired. How I overcome tiredness, I go to bed. So was first few months in Thailand as a monk. That I was really tired. I was not physically, not so mentally tired, but physically weak. So I went out to another monk, you know, more senior than me, about 2 or 3 years senior than me, and said, look, I'm really, really tired. Can you advise? You know, some meditation to get some more energy up. And he said to me, eat more rice. I never thought of that. I thought I should strive, you know, do something, get some mental object like, you know, energy and just breathing in power, breathing out tiredness. Sorry, eat rice. It's obvious because I wasn't eating enough. I wasn't getting enough fuel into my body. So I increased, you know, the amount of rice I ate. Problem solved. Sometimes the obvious sort of solution, you know, like if you're tired, go to bed. We don't think about, no, not go to bed. There must be some other reason. You know, must have, I'm just not right meditation object. Must have another meditation object. So the obvious ones. If your partner suddenly goes off with someone else and cuts you out of their life, is there any way to let go of the feelings of disbelief, sadness and jealousy through meditation? Not through meditation, but through wisdom. Look, if your partner has just dumped you, imagine what a terrible person they are. And so now, that person they've gone off with is going to just really reap the bad karma. They're going to put up with your ex-husband. Serves them right. So, in other words, let them go. Your partner has suddenly gone off with someone else, cut you out of their life, and it means that you're better off without them. It wasn't really a partner, but I remember falling in love when I was about 19. This beautiful girl. We were together about over 6 months, deeply in love. And one day, she dumped me for someone else. Thank you. Oh, if I ever meet that girl again, I will bow down to her and say, thank you for dumping me. If you hadn't have dumped me, I would have never become a monk. I would never actually just, you know, had this great joy and peace of being a great monk. Oh, thank you, girlfriend, for dumping me. So, if you find that someone else who took away your partner, please thank them. Now you're free! So letting go seems impossible. Well, you've got no choice. They're already gone. So just go with the flow. Let them go. Can loving kindness meditation work if you practice it a lot? Absolutely. Is it possible to reach forgiveness? Of course it is. Now why not? Forgiveness is meaning they are not going to hurt you again. It's really weird, isn't it? So whoever that partner is, they've gone off about your ex-partner and the person who took them away. And then they hurt me. Why did they do that? Why did they do that? Every time you remember it, they're hurting you again. So to me, only hurt me once. You cheat me, you take away something, you steal my condensed milk. Things I'm really attached to. No, I'm not. But you hurt me once, but I never think about it again. Someone calls you stupid. They come up to me and say, Ajahn Brahm, you're an idiot. What do? I don't go thinking, they call me an idiot. They've got no right. They don't know who I am and how hard I work. I'm not an idiot. They've got no right. I should not allow them in Jhana Grove anymore if they call me an idiot. I'm going to sue them. And I finally realize they've been calling me an idiot every time I remember it. Actually, they're right. I'm an idiot if I get angry at that. So they call me an idiot once and that's it. I let it go. Ajahn Chah used to teach, if somebody calls you a dog, which is a bad thing, that's a really bad word for a dog, they call you a dog, call you Ma, what should you do? He says, they call you a dog. then you should look at your bottom. See if you have a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're obviously not a dog. End of problem. If you have got a tail, oh, thank you. I didn't realize that. Thank you so much for pointing that out to me. Either way, you don't get upset. Is it still possible for thoughts to arise even when one has been silently focused on the breath for a substantial amount of time? Yes, but those thoughts are not really strong. You can let them go very easily. It's like the thoughts are in the background somewhere. Like, you know, sometimes you're in deep meditation or you're walking meditation, it sounds like a long way away. And they're right next to you, but they feel so far away, so focused on the silence. I've noticed if I indulge in the thoughts, my breath gets heavier and the level of deepness in the meditation is lost. Thanks. So you don't indulge in them. Indulge, instead of indulging, entangled in them, giving them importance. The old story, first saw this going through Changi Airport, Terminal 3, because that's where the Perth flights are, the Australian flights. And then, middle of Terminal 3, there's this big TV, whatever it's called, and on that monitor they have soccer matches, EPL, all the time. And so, I was passing there, and this gentleman jumped up and said, "That's not offside! That wasn't offside, that was a goal!" I said, "Why is he doing that? Why is he shouting at the screen?" Number one, doesn't matter how loud you shout in Singapore, the match happened in Liverpool. They cannot hear you. And number two, it's a replay. 3 days ago that happened. Have you seen your husband's doing that at a cricket match? That was not LBW. That was not right. And you may be at home here in Perth, and a match is happening in Colombo, and they still shout at the screen. It's stupid, isn't it? And for the girls, when I was a student, we took our girlfriends, I remember this, we took our girlfriends, two or three of us guys and the girlfriends, to see West Side Story. This was Romeo and Juliet set in New York. A doomed love affair. Tony, who was Italian, Maria, Puerto Rican. Doomed. And they were just two beautiful people trying their best in this world, good, kind, they loved each other so deeply, but from the wrong side of the tracks. So in the end, the last few minutes, somebody, it was actually Maria's brother, was trying to kill Tony. And Maria was searching for him in the middle of the night in the west side of New York, the poor areas. Trying to find him, to warn him that her brother had a gun, was trying to shoot him. And finally he saw Tony, or she saw Tony. Maria saw the love of her life under one of the street lights. It was raining, it was dark, it was cold. And she shouted out to warn him, "Tony!" And at that moment, the brother also saw him and pulled the trigger. And in the darkness, the silence of the night in the west side of New York, the bullet whizzed into Tony. He slumped. He was dying. And Maria ran towards him, took him in her arms. He was still alive, as somewhere in the 2 a.m. in New York, an orchestra started, and they sang. They didn't actually call for an ambulance. Instead, they sang. "There's a place for us, somewhere a place for us." That was the theme song. And all the girls sitting next to us, they were crying their eyes out. Streams of tears were coming down their face. As for this was in like the 60s, 70s, the sensitive guys, we were laughing our heads off. "It's only a movie. It's not real. It's a movie. You know it's going to happen. You know, you read the script, you've seen it before. And anyway, I told the girlfriends afterwards, look, this proves Buddhism. Just wait for a few minutes and Tony will get reincarnated in the next showing of the movie. But why do you get entangled like that? It's only a movie, but if you're watching the sports match, it's like, you know, the reason why you shout is because you get drawn in. And the psychology of a man watching a cricket match, even if it's a replay, they're right there in the stadium. They really feel that they can actually shout out and affect the result. That you, if you're crying at a weepy movie, you get drawn in, and that is, you know, your family member. You're so close to them. You're right there. Some people even shout out, look out, Maria! You know, Tony! You can't. They can't hear you. But we get so entangled, we believe they can. And that's exactly what happens with your thinking. You get entangled in it. You get emotionally involved in those thoughts, those fantasies, those dreams, those memories. So if you can actually just move back from your thoughts, and just say, it's only a replay, doesn't really matter, that means that the thoughts don't hold you. Okay, I better be quick, otherwise I'm going to be over time again. Dear Ajahn, I found it difficult to do sitting meditation for more than 15 minutes, as I was feeling very sleepy. Walking meditation was comparatively better. How do I overcome this? Easy! Just ask somebody to pretend to be the Zen master with a stick, and then you won't feel sleepy at all. Give them permission, because legally you have to give them a waiver that you won't sue them for assaulting you. Or even better, just go and sit on the edge of the stupa, right on the very edge. If you're sleepy, you'll fall over and hit your head. Or even better, no, we'll get a snake from the zoo, and I'll put it in here during the meditation time, and then you won't get sleepy. Or even better, I'll get somebody to pretend to be a ghost and turn the lights out. Ooh. No, you don't do stuff like that. You don't use fear. You use wisdom. So if you're sleepy, let yourself be sleepy. Check out if you're having enough rest at night. Make sure that you're not thinking too much. Because all those things, they just tire the brain out. That's all it is. Dear Ajahn, for the last few days I've been experiencing some emotional pain, feelings I now know have been avoided for some time. It has been painful and I've needed to cry during long walks to release the tension. I have considered leaving, but I trusted this process regardless of the path. Do you have any insight to share or any words of encouragement? It's been a distressing few days. When you end this retreat, you can always ask for your money back. You won't get it back, but we can always ask. Yeah, you can if you want. But no, this too will pass. It's a beautiful little saying. It was the emperor's ring story. That an emperor, young guy, didn't know what to do, taking over the kingdom. So every time things were going well, every time there was a mining boom, they would spend all their money doing all these big projects like Elizabeth Key and all this sort of stuff, raising people's... If you're West Australian, you know what I'm talking about. And as soon as the boom had ended, oh, he got so negative, he'd spend all the days in his room being depressed. So this was the king, he didn't know how to run a kingdom, and you can't tell people how to run a kingdom. You have to be sneaky. So the ministers met together and they said, we're going to get you a ring, very simple ring, and on the outside was written the words, this too will pass. Told the young king to wear that at all times. So when life was going well, boom, everyone was happy with the government, people were very confident, and he'd always remember the ring, this too will pass. So even during the good times, he never took them for granted. He worked, knowing that good times will fade. When he was healthy, he'd still make sure he kept that health. He didn't take it for granted. when jhana grove with a lot of people still work. Don't take it for granted. This too will pass. And when it did pass, and there was bad economy, he realized it's no one's mistake. It passes this naturally. So he kept on working. No, even the bad times will pass. And that way he became a very effective emperor. In the bad times, it's going to pass. Just hold on for a little bit. Keep on working. Economies go down. Economies go up. That's the nature of life. So that's a beautiful little saying, this too will pass. When people get depressed, it passes. But remember to keep that in mind in the good times. When you're healthy, it's good now, my everything is good, everything is fine. It will pass. Sometimes I tell monks that, I tell those monks, I say, how are you feeling today? They're doing great. So it won't last. And it's a bit of a joke, but it's important to say, well, don't take it for granted. So it's great. You can cry, do some work, be experiencing some emotional pain feelings. But remember, don't indulge in the emotional pain. See if you can let it go. If it's somebody hurt you or you hurt yourself, only hurt yourself once. Let it go. It's in the past. Don't need to keep bringing it up. Focus on the present moment. And if you feel really negative, the story, which was very powerful, keep on saying it. When you go for a walk, have a look at the trees in this forest and see if you can find the perfect tree, one which was dead straight, no marks on the trunk, all the branches in place, equally spaced, only green leaves on the twigs, no brown leaves, no leaves which have been eaten by the bugs. A perfect tree. They don't exist. In fact, if they did, they'd be just so boring. The beautiful ones, find the most beautiful tree in this forest, the one you like the most. You'll find it's the one which is all twisted and bent and crooked, with so many branches have been torn off by the storms of life. And in those holes, that's where the animals and the birds make their nests. That's a beautiful tree, all over the place. And the trunk all scarred, knobbled by the storms of life. That's beauty. So, don't complain about life, about what happened to you. That's what makes the beautiful character. The most beautiful tree in the forest is not what you think is perfect. It's what you know is perfect. And that's you. So I always tell people, if you've got a husband who's all bent and crooked and twisted and damaged, he's gorgeous. Just like you. Just want to apologize if I have spread negativity when doing kitchen duties. I was irritated once someone added a step to the process, which I think making the place messy and slowing us down. Later I pointed it out and turned out that person is rather nice. I'm sorry for that matter to all of us. No, it's one. We don't say sorry to the past. You learn from it. Say thank you for teaching me that sometimes I always think I'm right and sometimes I learn. So it's nice always to say, I'm imperfect. I use it at the end of the retreat. I apologize for all the bad jokes. All the silly things I've said. I once heard you say that when you are aware of the mind, you can see it clearly. Could you please explain? I don't remember that. When you're aware of the mind, you can see it clearly. No, you don't. You've got to have all the five hindrances gone, and then you can see things clearly. Can you please explain? I never said that. I'm innocent. I'm going to get a lawyer to prove that I'm innocent. Do we get some special energy power from meditating in the early hours of the day? Yes. This is a powerful time. As I said, that this is when most people get enlightened. At dawn. Yes, when the sun starts coming up and the lights emerge out of the darkness. The cool new energy of life arising in you. And when the light sort of starts to spread on the horizon. The light of Dhamma comes into your mind. And then you wake up and it's only a dream. So never mind. Anyway, yeah, special energy any time of the day. You have mentioned before how you have cured colds by being aware of and relaxing all different muscles in your nose and throat, etc. Could you please give us a few specifics on how you develop this level of body awareness? For example, is it by developing the body scanning practice? No, it is by not being afraid of focusing on discomforts in your body. And not trying to cure them. As soon as you see an ache or a pain in the body, you know, especially if it's not a really sort of life-threatening one or body-injuring one, you focus on it. Get to know it. Investigate it. Get really to understand what aches and pains are. But not if it's going to really cause you a lot of pain and a lot of injury. So once you actually feel it, you get to know, then experiment with it. Experiment just imagining like a string being stretched and you let go of both ends. Like something being squashed. And then you expand it. Being kind to it. A little bit of kindness. You play around with it until you know how it gets a bit less painful. And after a while you look at it and you just can relax it all away. So just find just ordinary little itches and pains and stuff. And then you can get to amazing stuff. Regarding the stimuli of the bus journey, if there's no drive, then who are we training in meditation? You're not training anyone, it's me doing it. I do all the work. I get into your head and I brainwash you. Honestly, this is sometimes that you get to deep meditation. Well, this is my only journey. And then sometimes there's a blockage and then an idea comes up and where did I get that one from? And then you remember, that was Ajahn Chah said that years ago. It's like a seed which has been planting in your brain or your mind somewhere. It just lies dormant until it's ready and necessary. At the time I never understood it, but I never forgot it. Just like that simile I keep saying of the mango orchard. And the only way to get the mangoes is to sit perfectly still underneath the mangoes, under the tree with your hand open. When I first heard that, I thought it was absolutely gomayang. But you know, it turned out to be just absolutely amazing stuff. I just rejected it at first. And years later, when I was ready for that type of teaching, it just came up. And it helped me so enormously. Ajahn Brahm, can you speak a little bit more about the five precepts? Do they have a deeper meaning? Is there a sutra that talks about the five precepts in detail? It's usually in the Vinaya they get into the five precepts and all this thing, which in much more detail. But a little more about the five precepts. Again, don't kill your defilements. You're doing damage to them. Be kind to them. Don't steal. What can you say, stealing? So taking what's not given. I want, I want, I want. So just like a monk, things have to be offered to us. So I don't go taking stuff. It's what you give to me. So just the mango tree gives you the mango. You don't take it and steal it. Not sort of misconduct in the senses. Just leave the senses alone. And they get very peaceful. Being truthful to life, to yourself. We always think in fantasies. The time when I get enlightened. What are you going to do when you get enlightened? Where are you going to go? Where are you going to teach? Well, some people, they're not really thinking about enlightened, but when I get enough psychic powers that I can see the lottery numbers. And what I will do, once I get the lottery numbers, I'll give 10% to Ajahn Brahm's monasteries and 90%. What are you going to do when you get rich? I'm going to get a boat and travel around the world. I am going to solve all the problems of the world. That's actually lying to yourself. And the last one, about letting go of intoxicants. The biggest intoxicants are the sensory pleasures or your sense of self, intoxicated with the ego. So you let go of all drugs and intoxicants, and you're free. I always make it up on the run, probably wrong, but anyway, sounds interesting. What happens to someone who really gets jhana but doesn't have enough of the Dharma to be nirvanaed? Psychic powers, dreamers, magic powers. But if you do the jhanas and you think it, you will them, you get big ego. And it's the ego, when you add the I to the jhanas, I achieved these, then that's where you get devadattas from. People who thought they were as good as the Buddha, even better than the Buddha, and try to kill the Buddha. So someone who regularly gets jhana but doesn't have enough of the Dharma, they become egocentric and it all goes pear-shaped. Lastly, have you heard of this temple in Thailand, Bangkok, called Dhammakaya? If yes, can you share some knowledge about this temple? I think it is also known as a temple of a million Buddhas and a million baht as well. I visited once and it is a very serene and peaceful place. Didn't seem to be a famous tourist spot, but for the locals they visit and stay for meditation too. Oh my dear, get on the internet, Dhammakaya. The abbot had to run away, accused of fraud. Be very careful. Don't just believe what you're told. Check it out and see for yourself. People can be very gullible at times. I remember this. They were collecting huge amounts of money. Be very careful. Don't ruin monasteries by giving too much money to them. Monasteries are okay, but not to monks or nuns. We don't have personal cash or money. Check them out. You can just see what I've got. You go in my room, in my cave, so you don't have expensive stuff there. I don't have Gucci shoes or Versace robe. But some monks do. Some monks get very wealthy. That's one of the reasons why if you give donations, give it to the temple, not to a monk. Monks were not supposed to have these things. It's supposed to be simple. And that to raise funds, I know this happened, I don't like saying these things, but the abbot there once said he's going to perform a psychic feat. And so, because I was in Malaysia at the time, I was the airport manager of Alor Setar airport, a small airport in North Malaysia. He was telling me about this, he saw it. He said they all went there, and there was an image of the Buddha appeared on the clouds. He saw it with his own eyes, psychic power. Of course, a few months later, they started having pictures of John Lennon on the clouds at rock festival. It was lasers. And it was just a trick to get money. That's really awful. So anyway, be careful sometimes that it's has some good things. And I feel a bit sorry for, because some of the Dhammakaya monks, the disciples, are really good people. But they've been, it's the leaders who cause all the problems. So be very careful. Just because they're a monk or a nun, look at their behavior. And if there's something doesn't feel right, just check it out. One of the problems in Thailand, and also Malaysia, Singapore, and other countries, you think, oh, if I criticize a monk, I'm going to go to hell. Don't criticize a monk. That's wrong. Criticize a monk or a nun or a leader, but make sure you've got your facts right. Make sure you're doing it out of kindness, out of gentleness, you know, out of love for the Sangha, not just to put somebody down or to destroy them, not to become better than they are, but coming from a really compassionate motive. Make sure you got your facts, the right time and the right place. Because that's actually how we got the rules of the precepts for. People saw us doing, monks and nuns doing the wrong thing, and you helped us out. For example, the last story I'm going to mention, it is the Bhikkhuni's Paticca number 8. It's one of the favorite stories about the monks' rules, or the nuns' rules, and just how very good criticism actually led to a very important rule for the Bhikkhunis. Because in those days, the Bhikkhuni monasteries used to be, you know, in quiet places, but in the city somewhere, or in the township somewhere, for safety. And then early one morning, there was a gentleman, he was actually walking down the road, past the monastery wall, it was a Bhikkhuni monastery, and he was really well dressed because he was going to an audience with the king. He was a businessman trying to get a really lucrative contract. So he was walking there in the early morning. They had these little, firebrands, like torches to light the way. No electricity in those days. There was some, I think, pitch or something, in order to light them, and in the early morning you could see where you're going. And he was walking there thinking about the business deal, not really thinking about anything else. And then suddenly, over the wall, came a big bucket of shit. Went all over him. Because what had happened, it was one of the nuns, the Bhikkhuni's job, was actually to empty out the latrine early in the morning. All the stuff which had got in there the night before, had a few buckets, and she was supposed to take them to the cesspit. But she was a bit lazy that morning, and so she threw them out, and then no one would be on the opposite side of the wall that time in the morning. And of course, there's one of the laws, which is essential law of Dhamma, is essential law of science as well, Murphy's Law. You know Murphy's Law? If it can happen, it will happen. And so according to Murphy's Law, when she threw the bucket of shit over the monastery wall, there just happened to be a man on the other side, received the whole lot. And you can imagine, he stopped thinking about the business deal. He was very much in the present moment. With shit running down his face and on his nice clothes. And he was really upset. So upset, he was so angry. Those nuns on the other side of the wall, they're not real nuns, they're not real compassionate, they're not mindful or wise, they shouldn't do this, I'm going to burn their monastery down. He took one of the brands of firebrands and he ran into the monastery with the full intent of angrily burning down the whole monastery. But there was a gatekeeper. And the gatekeeper said, "Where are you going?" "Not what they did to me! You can't throw this stuff over me." And the gatekeeper, he should have either been a politician or a second-hand car dealer. Because this gatekeeper said, "What? You've been blessed by holy shit from holy nuns? This is not usual. This is incredibly auspicious. You've heard about holy water. Now this is even much more powerful than holy water." He said, "Wow, you are so lucky." And this businessman was so gullible, believing every word of it. He said, "Listen," said the gatekeeper, "just go home quickly. So get washed and dressed and get the smell off you, get a new pair of clothes on. And I'm sure you'll get enormous good luck today." And he believed that. So he went home, got changed, and went to the palace, and he got awarded this incredibly lucrative deal from the king. A really good contract. And so he forgot about burning down the monastery, but instead he told his friends. Business people, you have drinks together, you have lunch, and you talk about, how to do well in business. He said, listen guys, if you really want to do well in your business, forget about this sprinkling water, get the real stuff. It worked for me. So the word got around that if you really want to do well in business, get the real holy stuff. And of course, sooner or later, a few monks heard that, and they told the Buddha, and the Buddha told the nuns, "You're really lucky that you had this gatekeeper who could spin more than Tony Blair. You are so fortunate, but don't do it again. You're very lucky this time." So the eighth Pajitya rule for bhikkhunis, you can check it out for yourself, is any bhikkhuni, any nun who throws a bucket of shit over the monastery wall incurs the offence of Pajitya, which has to be confessed. That's one of the rules in the nun's Patimokkha. So anyway, so what am I talking about that for? I don't know. Something about, oh yes, serene and peaceful place. So anyway, so if you see anything wrong, if you're actually going past Bodhinyana Monastery and a bucket of, you know what, comes over the wall, it's not a blessing, okay? You go and tell me or tell somebody and we'll make sure it never happens again. So that's that story. Okay, little stories to entertain you tonight. So, now we can do the three sadhus. Sadhu! 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 And please, don't go asking the nuns for a blessing tonight. Okay. Okay, have a nice night. See you tomorrow morning. Mm-hmm.